Iran is an example of a harmonious combination of the principles of religion, human rights, and national interests. We maintain a high intensity of political and economic dialogue between our countries. Russian-Iranian cooperation is reaching a qualitatively new strategic level, despite the illegal pressure of unfriendly countries.
The guests of the reception all believed in one thing. The stability of Iran's Islamic revolution is due to the unquestioning support of people. Iranians are defending their revolution despite constant propaganda, as well as huge funds to overthrow its results.
The anniversary of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution is commemorated in Russia every year. As the two countries continue to expand ties, Russian political elite pay their respect to Iran. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Iranians from different walks of life have participated in the commemoration rally from all parts of the metropolitan Tehran to the iconic Azadi Square to mark and celebrate the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution and renew allegiance with the ideals of the revolution.
The Iranian nation toppled the US-backed Pahlavi regime 44 years ago, ending 2,500 years of monarchy in the country. The Islamic Revolution led by Imam Khomeini established a new political system based on Islamic values and democracy.
The celebration was held in Tehran and over 1,400 cities and 38,000 villages around the Islamic country.
We are here to support our country and we are here to tell the U.S. to back off so that we can make more improvements in our country. We're going to support this government, this country forever. We're going to support our supreme leader. So you just have to stop interfering in our affairs. And we want to say that down with the U.S. because you've been the cruelest country in the world.
We celebrate the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution to show the world that despite all riots and plots hatched by the enemies, our Islamic Revolution is strong and powerful. We love our leader and the Islamic Revolution and are ready to sacrifice our life for the ideals of our revolution.
Addressing crowds of people at Azadi Square, Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, said West's policy of imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed, thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation.
West's policy imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed, thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation. The United States and its allies failed to stop the Iranians from making progress. The Iranians managed to make the enemy's plots futile. The West, the U.S. in particular, stands accused of human rights violations by waging wars in countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen. The West must be held accountable for its crimes in the region.
The demonstrators underlined the necessity of preserving national unity and avoiding any measure that would foment division and sedition in the country. Analysts believe that after 44 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and despite different forms of conspiracies against Islamic establishment, Iran has now been turned into a beacon of hope for freedom seekers and the oppressed nations of the world. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran's oil-rich city of Ahwaz is hosting 270 local firms active in the production of petroleum equipment, as well as contractors of mega oil projects, to take part in the 13th Ahwaz Oil Show. The aim of the four-day event is to support manufacturers of key petroleum equipment that are on the list of U.S. sanctions.
We have invited all of the local companies operating in oil well services, instrumentation, and the production of any equipment that's required in the oil and gas industry. They are here to achieve synergy with each other and state-owned firms with the ultimate goal of increasing our oil production.
For decades, Iran relied on drilling bits produced by Germany, the U.S., and even China to pump its crude. But U.S. oil embargoes on Iran made it almost impossible to import efficient bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This forced Iran to try its own know-how to build its needed machinery from drilling bits to pipelines.
After almost 110 years of dependence on the import of drilling bits, our engineers at Asmari, along with other Iranian firms, have been able to indigenize the bit technology. So we design and manufacture a range of drilling bits locally, and this is thanks to the restrictions caused by sanctions.
With regard to sour service pipes, our company used to import them for its oil-related projects. We didn't need to reinvent the wheel, but after Trump imposed sanctions on Iran in 2018, we put our heads together and managed to produce our own anti-corrosion pipelines.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Following the U.S. reimposition of sanctions against Iran in 2018, Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs. That's why the government in Iran is now making a seismic shift to local manufacturers to rebuild its oil sector, a long-term goal which, if accomplished, will make the country an oil power.
About seven decades ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. Today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector, something which experts here describe as another turning point in the oil industry, as it would shield the country's economy from the impacts of oil embargoes. Yusuf Jalali, Ahvaz.
In line with a fourth meeting of Iran and Russia media cooperation, a delegation of Russian television executives, as well as TV and radio station managers, led by the Russian Deputy Minister of Digital Affairs, visited the IRIB World Service's TV and radio stations. That included the Spanish channel Hispan TV and the English news network Press TV, a chance for the Russian delegation to observe the technical developments up close.
Both the Russian and the Iranian side have reached a point where they are ready for practical steps after holding several rounds of meetings and signing cooperation agreements. We have laid the groundwork, and our audience will soon be enjoying our joint TV and radio productions.
The visit also provided the opportunity to discuss potential areas of cooperation.
We can cooperate in exchange of content. It's movies, TV series, it's cartoons and documentaries. There is a very broad field.
The details were carefully discussed in order to break down the steps and see how the two sides can take cooperation to the next level. First and foremost, representatives were appointed from both sides to be directly in touch and to be in charge of joint media productions from now on.
Iran and Russia are both under pressure and sanctions by Western countries, so this meeting and the one we had 2 days ago are of strategic importance. There is great potential, and I believe that we can immediately begin joint radio production.
But the highlight of this meeting was how to neutralize Western sanctions, particularly in the field of media, with the Iranian side sharing its valuable experiences in this regard.
We are witnessing a new world order, and under these circumstances, regional and international powers such as Russia, Iran, and China will be growing closer and develop stronger alliances. Russians are experiencing sanctions aimed at isolating them since the war in Ukraine has begun. We can share years of experience with them in this regard. Our media cooperation not only allows unheard voices to be heard, but it will also reshape public opinion.
Both sides agree that the groundwork has prepared and joint production can start in 2023, marking the beginning of a strategic alliance in a multipolar world where all voices can be heard. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello,
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Russia is calling for an emergency meeting to be held by NATO regarding the September 26, 2022 explosions of the Nord Stream gas pipelines. Now, this after renowned American journalist Seymour Hersh has written that the United States is responsible for the explosions. Now, he said that U.S. President Joe Biden gave the order and the American Navy divers put explosives on the pipelines under the cover of NATO war games held in the region. Now, even though this information is quite explosive, mainstream media is either ignoring the bombshell altogether or downplaying it. But the ramifications of this revelation may play a major role or the restructuring of the unipolar world. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst out of Brussels. And Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst out of Raleigh, North Carolina.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me on the program. I'll start this off with Gilbert out of Brussels. Your assessment of Hersh's revelation, I mean, do you think that his accusations will be followed up by American officials or journalists?
Well, my personal opinion here is not a great consequence. I would like to use this opportunity to confirm that I have received today from two sources who are authoritative, very respectable, and well informed about the career of Seymour Hersh, who have written to me and to others that they have great confidence in the veracity and in the comprehensive truths that Hersh has presented on his website a couple of days ago. One of these is a retired U.S. diplomat with a distinguished career, who was in his later posts the ambassador to one of the major countries in the Middle East. He has confirmed to me and to several others the integrity of Hersh, his understanding that Hersh's exposés of various abuses by the U.S. government going back decades were always well-founded and well-presented, and that Hersh has been the vehicle for bringing these abuses to the public precisely because those who divulged what they knew, and these are people in the administration of Joe Biden, they understood his ability to protect his sources and the persuasiveness and authority that he would bring to the publication of these materials. The second confirmation comes from an equally authoritative and valuable source from a different field completely. That is a professor of law at the University of Illinois, who wrote to me that going back to 1969, he was greatly impressed by Hersh's exposés on the U.S. biological warfare programs. The man involved, the lawyer involved, is himself became the drafter of the implementation legislation that was introduced and passed in Congress in 1989, 1990, implementing the General convention on prohibiting biological weapons. So his personal experience and knowledge of Hirsch going back to 1969 was later confirmed by many other exposés, the My Lai massacre and the Abu Ghraib torture to span several decades of investigative reporting which were signed by Seymour Hirsch. For these reasons, we welcome the Russian initiative to bring Hirsch and other journalists material about this war crime to the attention of NATO and to other international institutions.
Okay. Stay with me, Gilbert. Let me get Ray in on this. Well, I mean, listening to what our guest in Brussels said, basically, he's saying that from what others are, people who are quite reputable are saying, that this is quite likely, quite possibly to be the truth. So, Ray, my question to you is, why aren't we seeing this bombshell explode in mainstream media and talking about this? This is a war crime. What's going on, Ray?
Well, I could profess to be shocked, but it's par for the course. And everything that Dr. Doctora has just said is true about Cy Hirsch. So despite all that, or actually because of his reputation for veracity and for protecting his sources, the U.S. media won't touch it in any real way. Now, it speaks volumes, and this is perhaps as equally important of the aspect of the story. Cy Hirsch wrote for the New York Times, got Pulitzer Prize, got five other kinds of Polk Awards, and then he wrote for the New Yorker magazine, and then he wrote for the New York Review of Books and the London Review of Books, and the last expose he had to write for Die Welt, German newspaper whom he had a contact. Now he has to publish on his own Substack. My God, that speaks volumes. Now, the question is, will this Substack, and I am confident, I know now that Hirsch's thing has been translated into German, will the Germans look at it, and will they will they download that clip which shows Olaf Scholz standing next to Joe Biden, when Joe Biden says, we will end Nord Stream 2, and Scholz looks on, and he's asked, what about this? And he said, well, we do everything together. Together, we do everything. Will the German people ask Olaf Scholz now and his Bayerbock deputy, foreign minister, will they ask him, did you do this together, Olaf? Or was this a surprise to you? That the United States did. Okay, that the United States did it is a no-brainer, let's face it.
Right. Well, you know, you brought up an interesting point, Ray, about the Germans. Dr., I'd like to get your perspective on that because, I mean, it's quite amazing in some ways when we look at the ramifications of all of this, what happened to begin with and how it has affected the Germans and other European countries. And, of course, basically officials being part of the American hegemony, just going along with it. Do you think that this will backfire? Do you think that the Europeans, at least if not Americans, but Europeans will actually demand some answers? Because Russia is demanding that NATO investigates this and hold those accountable, responsible. But your perspective on that?
I'm sitting in Belgium, and I was just looking today at our newspapers. Surprised again, in the sense that that Ray had it. There's not a word about Cy Hirsch. There's not a word about his expose of the explosions. So the European, and I look at the French newspapers. They are quiet. They are no more involved, no more forthcoming than American media. There's no surprise there either, because for years now, European newspapers and media have taken their cues from Washington, D.C. Still in all, there is hope that there's some slow glacial movement in Europe and even in Germany will bring attention to this. I was very pleased to see today that there is finally a left-right agreement in Germany between on the Linke with their leader Sacher Wagenknecht and with representatives of the Alternative for Deutschland to stage to issue a manifesto for peace and to stage a demonstration at the Brandenburg Gate on the 25th of February, calling upon Chancellor Scholz to stop the shipments of heavy weapons to Ukraine and instead to take an active role in calling for peace negotiations. This is a small chink in the ice, but it is worth noting, and let us hope that more than a symbolic number of people turn out at Brandenburg Gate.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Your overall assessment, I mean, we're seeing a full-out attack on Russia. I mean, the Nord Stream explosions, obviously, this is one part of it. We continue to see the NATO expansion towards Russia until basically Moscow had no choice but to deal with Ukraine in the way it is. Do you see everything that the United States and its allies that have done basically has now backed itself in the corner? Because it seems like, I mean, with the economic sanctions that they have targeted Moscow with, basically, Russia is back to where it was at the start of the war when we look at it from an economic perspective and starting to expand other relations. I mean, your overall assessment of this, has the U.S. backed itself in the corner?
Well, the U.S. has isolated itself. You talked earlier on, or you mentioned the bipolar or the multipolar world was your phrase. I see it as bipolar, not only in the psychiatric sense, but in the realpolitik sense. It's the lily white West against people of color who represent 80% of the rest of the world and Russia. Russia has been blackened to the point where it's people of color as well. So what we have is a new correlation of forces. The problem is that the people who are running U.S. foreign policy are from the elite schools where they learn that the U.S. is exceptional. Now, they believe that. I mean, they think that the U.S. can just throw its weight around. This started 2 years ago when the U.S., when Blinken and Blinken and Sullivan read the Riot Act to China, saying you got to obey the new rules-based order that we make the rules on. And it's continued right down the, and the problem is that we all know what's going to happen in the next couple of months. I'm convinced that Russia is going to move as far west as they will without some indication of real bona fide negotiations on part of the U.S. in Ukraine, I'm talking, of course. And then the decision will be, well, were we wrong? Are we no longer exceptional? Or do we have to raise the ante still more and threaten the use, God forbid, of nuclear weapons? Nuclear weapons will not be a threat from the Russians. They don't need them in Ukraine. We will have people arguing that, yeah, maybe just a little tactical nuclear weapon might come in handy at this point. That's the danger.
Well, we look at, Dr. O, also Russian expansion. We look at its influence over more and more African countries, where it seems that the U.S. and its allies are losing more and more of its influence, whether we're talking about Northern Africa, South Africa, Mali, Burkina Faso. Tell me, how do you see this, assess all of this, that more and more countries are leaning towards the big bear than the stars and stripe, and Washington's reaction to all of this?
Well, it's more than just Russian initiative. It's an American withdrawal. The two things have gone hand in hand. Yes, the Russians have been very keen to sign up more and more countries to at least abstain and hopefully vote their way in various contentious votes in the United Nations and in other global fora. They have had a lot of success. Some of this is maybe attributed to the remarkable successes of the Wagner private military company, which has been working in precisely the areas that you've just mentioned, and has proven itself to be a more valuable ally to the governments in holding peace than the French or other former colonial powers who have been displaced by the Russian entry. But I think we're really, first of all, looking at nose counting. Secondly, we're looking at the Russians changing their foreign policy from what it had been in the Soviet period. I was present a few years ago at a meeting in Moscow of parliamentarians, to which a number of African countries had been invited. And the head of the Communist Party of the Russian Federation was present at this reception and party, and it was glowing, as if the good old days of the Soviet Union were coming back. No, they're not coming back. The Russian Federation is a very different entity with a very different set of principles for governing very efficiently and for managing foreign policy in a way that is not, that is constructive and not destructive of Russia's finances. In the past, Russia had given out a lot of financial aid and military aid and received little or nothing back. That's the Soviet period. That's gone. The Russians are playing an American game now in making foreign policy a contributor to their net wealth rather than a loss of their net wealth. And this pertains to their activities in Africa, where they have been very keenly tying in military support, and like the Wagner Group, with contracts that they conclude in the mineral extraction industries and other wealth of these countries that formerly was in the hands of the colonial overlords.
Well, Ray, we also see expansion with Russia with these various alliances they have, such as BRICS or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and these countries involved in that, and also looking for alternative banking system, international system. Your assessment of that, and where do you think this is going?
Well, the bilateral agreements now between Russia and China, Russia and Iran, Russia and many other countries sound the death knell for the primacy of the dollar in international trade. Again, the economists advising Biden don't seem to be any brighter than the ones advising him on foreign policy. So that's the big change. I would say that China has to be emphasized here because there has been a tectonic change in what the Russians used to call the world correlation of forces, and that is that we have Russia and China now in a virtual alliance which has no upper end, read military alliance if it comes to that. That's a marked change, and mark my words, that if there's a dust-up, if there's a armed conflict in Europe involving Russia and the West, you can expect lots of trouble, armed trouble, in the South China or the East China Sea or maybe even the Taiwan Straits. Now, that's what the U.S. policymakers, bright as they pretend to be, have gotten the U.S. into, and it's a no-win situation. You just don't go two against one. And the one is the United States now, and it's got the short end of this isosceles triangle.
What does that mean, Dr. You heard Ray McGovern say about the alliance, growing alliance between China and Russia. As he talked about the advisors to Biden, what is it? Is it the fact that the United States cannot accept a multipolar world, them not being on top, or if they can't lead, they don't care if the whole thing is destroyed? I mean, your assessment of this, obviously there should be some people advising against what they're doing.
Well, people who are advising against what they're doing are like Ray and myself in dissident status outside the inner circles of power. I think you've rightly touched on the de-dollarization as one of the most significant developments in the last year. And the wars are measured by tanks and men on the ground and artillery pieces. That is a traditional and very easy to understand aspect of war. But since the very beginning of the Russian special military operation, when the United States froze, or shall we say confiscated, $350 billion of Russian reserves, the economic dimension of the war has been hard to miss. And that pertains to all aspects. The well-known doyen of the realist school of foreign relations in the United States, John Mearsheimer, was saying maybe 6 months ago, that explaining what the overall situation was in this conflict, that for Russia, the war is an existential war for its existence, whereas for the United States, this was an optional war that it could walk away from at any time. I have just read an analysis, which I found very persuasive, from a French historian, arguing that the war is now existential for the United States as well, precisely because the American means of maintaining its global hegemony, the financial weaponization of the dollar as a reserve currency, has been put in jeopardy. And if the Russians win on the ground, which appears to be the case, the Russians are also winning on the financial dimension in combination with Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, India, Iran, and China. It's not just China. There is a whole constellation of countries that have joined the United States, joined Russia, rather, quite willingly in a de-dollarization move.
Okay.
And that is in the most important commodity on earth.
All right. And on that note, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but we're out of time. I appreciate it. Very interesting discussion from both of you. Out of Brussels, Dr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, and out of Raleigh, North Carolina, former CIA analyst, Mr. Ray McGovern. A pleasure having both of you. And with that, that brings us to the end of this spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer. Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I'm now in Yazd province. Which city in this province? Mehriz city. I'm going to visit a beautiful historical caravanserai in Mehriz. Zeynuddin Caravanserai. I'm going to stay here at night and watch the stars in the sky of the desert. There is a 400-year history behind this caravanserai. Well, here I arrive. The tranquility and the silence of the desert where the caravanserai is located, the delight of watching the sunrise and sunset from the top of the building where nothing disturbs the view, and the historical value of the caravanserai are the reasons why staying at Zeynuddin Caravanserai is a highly recommended experience in Iran. So, let's head to this historical caravanserai. Zeynuddin Caravanserai is a magnificent caravanserai located in the heart of the desert in Yazd province, 60 kilometers from the city of Yazd. This monument is one of the most famous caravanserais of Iran, which is still in use as a unique accommodation for travelers. Zeynuddin Caravanserai was built during the Safavid era. The inn is in a completely different and traditional style and is now capable of accommodating hundreds of guests and tourists. For your information, caravanserais were roads roadside inns where travelers and caravans used to take a rest and spend the night after a day's journey, communicate with other travelers, and even trade some goods. Historical caravanserais of Iran, which hold many stories from the guests who spent a night and continued their journey the day after, are spread all over this country, especially on the Silk Road route, which passed through Iran and connected China to the west. Caravanserais, which are usually constructed with adobes and earth, are rectangular areas with a central courtyard surrounded by small rooms for accommodation. As we step into the middle of this year's cold winter, the weather gets mild and pleasant in southern provinces of Iran. That is why I usually take trips to the south in cold seasons. Anyway, let me tell you something. This caravanserai, besides being a historical monument, is a number one hotel at the heart of the desert. I have heard that international travel and tourism magazines have put the name of this caravanserai in the list of their best hotels in the world. And something else. Zainuddin Caravanserai got reconstructed about 20 years ago and received the prize of the best reconstruction from UNESCO in 2006. The room I have booked in this hotel is extraordinary. Here, there is everything you can have in a modern hotel. The only difference is that everything here is traditional. What a great thing is to be here! And now that I have been accommodated and moved my luggage, I prefer to take a tour around this caravanserai. A good idea. Exactly where every lover of historical monuments wants to see. You can even stay here at night. Wonderful! Zainuddin is one of the most unique caravanserais in Iran, and that is because of its architectural plan, which shows a circular building from outside and a dodecagon shape from inside. This structure is built by bricks, and the entrance of the rooms around the central courtyard are ornamented with well-formed arches. After passing the entrance gate, on the south of the building and the hashti, which is the vestibule or a small space leading to a larger space, you will enter the round space, which is originally a dodecagon surrounded by brick-made porticos leading to the small rooms where travelers stay. Beautiful. The hashti, or the vestibule, is continued by two long corridors that pass behind the rooms. Guess what? These corridors were used as horse stables. The room on the north side of the caravanserai was the shahnishin, a room used by the kings and governors, which is characterized by its high ceiling and ornaments, including stucco works. Very beautiful. This building is fenced by five brick towers that are attached to the 8-meter-high walls, which has resulted in a unique shape of architectural plan. As I said earlier, Zainuddin Caravanserai is renovated and is used as a wonderful inn or desert hotel in Iran with capacity for 100 travelers. Oh, I'm very hungry. Time for dinner. In this Iranian traditional environment, eating Iranian food, kebab and doul. I wish you were here. It was very delicious. Well, I finished my dinner. It's dark outside, and the only thing I need is going to the roof and watch the stars. On two sides of the caravanserai, there are stairs that lead to the roof. Oh my God! It's desert as far as the eye can see. Oh, I feel great. The stars are so near that you feel you can catch them by your hands. I really enjoy being here. And tonight, I sleep in a room which has brick walls, and its bed sheets are decorated with Iranian traditional clothes. And if you're interested in deserts of Iran and amazing experiences like staying at a caravanserai for a couple of nights and enjoying the beauties of desert, take a tour to Yazd province and have a memorable experience at Zainuddin Caravanserai. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This is